You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
All right. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another fantastic episode of Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron.
And I'm Susan Giddings.
Dr. Susan Giddings, man, your host, hostesses, and we're back again. So, another exciting week in the world of the Federal Bureau of Prisons. Things are kind of marching along with the new director. We had touched on some of that last week. Uh-huh. And there was a picture. Yes, there was a picture that I posted, or one of our members posted, of the new director and the pardon czar and all that, right? Uh-huh. And that was certainly a good vibes picture. Uh-huh. Boy, the positive comments were just a-flowing. Oh, this is a fresh start. Oh, and I love this kind of honeymoon, right, when we get a new director. Because everybody's spirits are high and the unicorns are starting to kind of come out of the bullpen. Just kidding. And so everybody is hoping for a very positive situation. And, you know, I'm going to go on record and say, just like anything else, there's going to be things that folks like, and then there's going to be things that folks aren't going to like. But let me say this while we have a fresh director and everybody's, and the cement hasn't dried, is that, and Susan, you know, you can fix what I'm about ready to ruin here, but the Bureau of Prisons is what? It's a bureaucracy. And you know, we do what we're told to do. We would do what we were told to do. I mean, it's a bureaucracy. We're stewards of the public trust, you know. Now we're in a position where we get paid to think, but we weren't, you know, we had to do what we were told to do. It's a paramilitary organization, and it's run by political officials. And so I just want to say from the outset, there's not people in the BOP sitting in a smoke-filled room trying to come up ways with how to jam people up. It just, you know, we get that a lot. So I just want to remind people of the bureaucracy that it is. We're hopeful. We're hopeful they'll make some new changes. And today we're probably going to talk about some of those changes that might come in the future, right? Yeah. In a perfect world.
So I do want to jump in with two things. First off, the Bureau posted it on their public site, and we've seen comments about this on our Facebook group. There are some nefarious characters out there that are running scams on families, and this is just about as low as you can go. The Bureau will never call you and say, oh, we need you to set up this account so that your loved one can transfer to halfway house, so that your loved one can transfer to home confinement. They're not going to call and ask you for money. They're certainly not going to talk to you about Zelle or Venmo or some crazy thing like that. That is just not how it happens. There is no subsistence pay. There used to be, and that went away in COVID, and then it was made permanent as we were coming out of COVID. Halfway house and home confinement are a program. Individuals who are in halfway house and home confinement are still serving their federal sentence. So just, you know, folks out there, if you get a call, the Bureau actually put information on their public site about reporting these scams. These are folks that are just taking advantage of family members who want their people to be home. And this is just 100% despicable. So please, 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 if you get those calls, ignore them, report them, go to the Bureau website at bop.gov. It's up there, an article with links of where to report. But yeah, please don't give out personal information. Don't send money. Yeah, just don't. That's not how the Bureau works. That's not how the government works. So
thank you for sharing that. Thank you for sharing that.
And then another little PSA. There is some wild rampant rumor, and we saw it all over Facebook starting yesterday, maybe late on Saturday, about President Trump is going to push everybody out of camps and into home confinement if they are minimum and low risk and within 5 years of release, or some variation of that rumor. That's not happening. If somebody is contemplating that in the White House, but be it President Trump or in Maine Justice as an option, it will take statutory change. There is no authority for individuals to be out in halfway house or home confinement in terms of direct sentencing, where a judge is sentencing someone, it's 12 months. In terms of halfway house or home confinement as part of pre-release placement, it's Second Chance Act or FSA. That's it. There is nothing else. And it will take Congress to get involved. It will take both sides to agree, which we all know that's kind of fun and amusing to watch. They're going to have to come together. That is a huge change, and that will take statute. So please don't believe it. I even said somebody even said, "Oh, if you Google, it's on Google." I did some searching, and then I made some calls to DC and there is nothing.
I mean, if we look at the chain of events in recent weeks, we had that whole thing weeks ago, the memo where all this Second Chance Act time was cut to 60 days. Why is it cut to 60 days? Why was it cut? Why did that even happen in the first place? I know why, because there's not a lot of bed space out there, right?
More money.
And so, money too, but also, right. Look, I mean, some places may have some, ample space. Some places are packed. I mean, we talked to people this last week in several different zones. They were packed. Ohio, Brooklyn, Texas, multiple sites in Texas, multiple sites in New York. So, I mean, these are Florida. Our clients, and they're not lying. You know what I mean? So they're like, man, people are stuffed in here. So look. So then if those spaces don't exist now, here's this rumor floating around about everybody's going to get out with less than five. The beds aren't there. You can't make beds that aren't there. You can't come out with a wave of tens of thousands or thousands of people coming out to an already burdened system. So,
home confinement, even if we were talking home confinement still requires equipment, whether it's ankle monitors or like almost Fitbit like devices, wristwatch rather than on the ankle. There's different systems, but it still requires equipment, which means it still requires money.
And the staff have to monitor, and people have to come in, and you got to do the checks and the home checks, and you got to come in at least once a week, and you got to pee and do all your stuff, reporting to the center once a week, particularly in the early part of that. So, I mean, and in order to do that, you have to have a spot in that halfway house. It's just, it would be a home confinement spot, but a spot nonetheless, right?
Right.
So,
and let's talk about home confinement versus halfway house for just a second. On the money front, there's a lot of talk in Washington about saving money and cutting bureaucracy. And personally, I'm a fan of that. I believe in cutting through the crap and saving some money. Why is home confinement so much less than halfway house? Because the infrastructure of the halfway house organization is there. So it becomes an add-on, the home confinement piece of it, because it's the same staff that are running the halfway houses are also supervising home confinement. So it's merely an add-on component. So therefore, when it comes to funding of home confinement, it becomes, and I'm going to use the word nominal, obviously nothing in government is nominal, but compared to the mandate rate for halfway houses versus the mandate rate for home confinement, it's substantially less. And because it's an add-on, they're not having to create whole new infrastructure, hire new people, and create a new center that just handles home confinement. We keep the cost of home confinement. The Bureau keeps the cost of home confinement down because it's piggybacked with the halfway house and the halfway house staffing. So that's why it does work. but we can't overwhelm that system, because if a given halfway house has, pick a number, 10 staff, and their contract, their existing contract is to manage 40 home confinement and 80 people in a halfway house, and I'm just making numbers up at this point in time, we can't turn around and say, oh, we're going to have that 10 staff, those 80 halfway house beds, but instead of 40 in home confinement, we want you to monitor 200 or 300. It just doesn't work. Like, we have to expand the entire infrastructure. We can't just go, oh, yeah, let's throw 300 people over here.
Dr. Giddings, I have a question. Why does it have to be by statute? Why can't somebody just with their magic wand make, with some money, throw some money at it, and poof, the beds are there? Why does it have to be by statute?
Sure. So how the Bureau of Prisons is given their authority to house individuals remanded to the custody of the Attorney General for service of their sentence by statute. The Bureau just didn't magically open up their doors one day and said, oh, come and bring us folks. We'll house them for you. This was, you know, the Bureau was created by statute, just like everything in government has some basis, even if there's mission creep along the way. But initially, they're created by statute. And within that statute, it spells out where we can house people. Because if an individual is sentenced for a 60-month sentence, the different statutes allow the Bureau to do different things. Where can we house them? Where can the Bureau put someone? Prior to the Second Chance Act, Bruce and I are getting ready to release a new book in the very immediate future. And we talk about, yes, very soon. And we talk about the Second Chance Act. We talk about the history of the Second Chance Act. So back before the Second Chance Act, the Bureau was limited to 6 months in halfway house, 10% home confinement. And for a very, very long time, the Bureau interpreted home confinement to be limited to 10% of your sentence, while halfway house, we could do up to 6 months. And around, I don't have the date in front of me, around 2003, 2004, maybe. Actually, I think it was maybe 2002, 2003. Maine Justice came out with the famous LOC letter, OLC letter, Office of Legal Legislative something, OLC. Anyway, Maine Justice came out with a letter and said, Bureau, you're doing it wrong. That 10% is halfway house or home confinement. So the Bureau went from being allowed to refer people up to 6 months, limiting home confinement to 10%, went, nope, everybody's limited. We can only put people out to 10%. Maine Justice said, the Bureau, you misinterpreted the law. And that went back and forth for several years. There were lawsuits, habeases were filed, the Bureau's doing this. The Bureau was kind of stuck in the middle because, again, as Bruce said, Bureau does what they're told, right? And Maine Justice, who has oversight of the Bureau of Prison, said, you can't do this. So it was the Second Chance Act that said, one, a halfway house is a place of incarceration. And Bureau, you can now extend halfway house up to 12 months. You're still limited to 10% of a sentence or 180 days on home confinement, but you can do this halfway house component up to a year. That was done by statute. So we see what was kind of pre-Second Chance Act, post-Second Chance Act, and then FSA rolls along and throws this new thing in the mix. So, but yeah, what the Bureau does is by statute, and being able to, when we can put people in the community, the Bureau, it's not just a policy that the Bureau decided we're not putting people in halfway house for.
So here's another example of this by statute. 924C. Got people in camps, minimum out custody. But guess what? The statute doesn't allow for them to get First Step Act.
And why is that? The reason they can be in a camp is because the Bureau, under their custody classification, does get to dictate, right, how we assess individuals and we make decisions about security levels and how who can be housed and who can't be. And 924C is a great example because the Bureau, when they're doing custody classification, is looking at the actual conduct that the individual was involved in. And we all know that the 924C statute, you might have some violence, you may not have some violence. It might have been in conjunction with a violent crime, but it also could have been in conjunction with a drug crime. It could have just been on your person, or you could have been firing at somebody, right? There's a continuum of activity that falls under 924C. The Bureau, in making a custody classification decision, looks at the actual conduct and says, is there actual violence? And if there's not actual violence, they get to go over to, it's a firearms violation, and they can go to a camp. But if there's actual violence involved in it, and it's bumped up to a greatest severity offense because of actual violence, then they're not going to a camp. And that's because the Bureau isn't just looking at, in terms of custody classification, isn't just looking at one line and saying, oh, you go this way. They're actually getting in and looking at the case and approaching it in a more nuanced approach, which arguably that's what we should see with FSA, which is something it's probably good. That's a good segue to talk about, start talking about. Last week we started talking about some of the problems and possible solutions. And we just kind of start tackling that at the tail end of the hour. So I thought we could pick up a little bit and move forward. Over the last, since the first of the year, we've really started talking about the fact of how many people aren't given the opportunity to earn time credits. and that's for two different reasons. And last week we talked about folks with high and medium risk and versus low and minimum. But when you look at the number of people that don't even have a shot at it, and because I'm the geek of the two of us, actually went and pulled some numbers. We were challenged. We published an article and we talked about the 65% of the population that doesn't get the opportunity, either because of statute or because of their risk level. And I won't say we were called liars outright, but, you know, somebody didn't like our assessment. I mean, so, you know, go ahead.
It's the numbers, right? I mean, these are the numbers. We don't make the numbers.
We did not make those up. We actually pulled those numbers from the 2024 the most recent annual report. The FSA law requires DOJ to publish an annual report. And there's a lot of statistics and a lot of numbers in there. I think what's interesting is what's not in there, but we'll leave that for another discussion. But when you look at the numbers, and if anyone is interested, it's on page 19 of the report, 50,000. Now this was of course based on, this was data as of January of 2024. So obviously individual numbers and percents can change because the population is constantly changing. But in January of 2024, when this data was pulled, almost 51,000 individuals were ineligible right off the top. Their offense made them ineligible. It didn't matter what the programming they did, they were ineligible. There was another 40,000. I have that number written down somewhere here in all these notes. Another almost 40,000, 39,000 that were ineligible because they were high or medium risk, right? And so when we said about 90,000, we were talking about those individuals within the court. Now, we didn't count the DC offenders when we talked about it because right now, the DC offenders are not included. And we can talk about the DC statute separately. That's a horrendous statute. But we're not counting the DC offenders. We're also, at any given time in the Bureau, because the pattern risk assessment and the FSA or the FSA eligibility is part of the initial classification. So at any given time, there's going to be a number of individuals that have just walked in the door and haven't gone to team. So we looked at those individuals who had been assessed, were determined to be ineligible or eligible, and had their pattern risk assessment. And that was 65%. It was about 90,000 out of about 137,000 individuals. That's a lot of people who don't even have a shot at it. And I see that as a problem.
So, of that, who would be the best risks to take? And
if we were going to expand eligibility?
What subset of that 90,000 would be in the future considered in our perfect world, which hasn't happened yet?
Right. So, you know, there's a couple of options, right? And I see it as, you know, kind of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. One's a little too hot, one's a little too cold. And then there's one in the middle. You know, for years, the Bureau under the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994 has been assessing whether an offense was violent or not. And that's been judicially tested all the way to the Supreme Court. The definition is settled. You could go to forget the statute and just consider, do they meet that crime of violence, that violent behavior? That's not looking at necessarily at the statute, that's looking at the offense conduct. And honestly, that would make less people eligible. So I would probably not go in that direction, honestly. The other side of the other extreme is to lift all statutory restrictions. And as long as you have a sentence with a release date, so you would exclude life sentences and death penalty cases, then you would be eligible to attempt to earn credit. But coming back to the real world, right? The FSA was bipartisan. Any changes are going to need bipartisan support. So if I was going to wave my magic wand, what would I do? I would look at offenses that involve actual serious bodily injury or death, so actual hands-on violence or threatened violence. You know, if someone is being threatened with a weapon, as an example, they weren't, you know, they were robbed. They weren't actually hurt, but they were threatened with a weapon and robbed, as an example, right? In terms of sexual offenses, I would again be looking at offenses with actual force, actual physical contact, and this is not a popular position to take, okay? A lot of sex offenders in federal prison are in there for pornography. They are not in prison for actual physical contact crimes. And honestly, do I want them incentivized to participate in programming so that maybe when they release, they don't continue that behavior? 100%. Even the prior offenses, if we look at the current law, the statute in terms of prior violent behavior is extremely obtuse and convoluted. Again, I would be looking at that same standard for the current offense in terms of actual threatened or actual physical contact, bodily injury, serious bodily injury, death, in terms of sex offenses, again, actual physical contact, but I would put it within a time frame. You know, if you had a serious violent offense and it was within the last 10 years, then you may need to cool your jets for a minute.
Right.
But even having said that, I don't even know that I would 100% exclude them. I would just put them to a higher standard of what they need to accomplish.
Right.
Maybe they need to be able to serve their sentence, at least 50% of their sentence before they're even considered. Maybe you include caveats that require them to not have any serious or violent misconduct while in prison. You know, set some criteria. We saw that with the elderly offender pilot. We've seen that with some other offense, with some other specialty programs where they looked at allowing reductions in sentences for certain cases. I would probably consider that as well. Again, if you have something really bad, but you come into prison and you do your time and you program and you're not continuing to engage in serious and violent misconduct, I think we need to consider, like, maybe there's been some behavior changes. Maybe, right. Maybe they're ready to be that new person.
Right. And so I'm down here in the state of Texas, and I'm involved with a lot of state cases. Okay. And I've got clients that were put into the state system with fairly egregious crimes, violent contact, those things. And yet, most, if not all, those guys that were sentenced under 5 years came out at 2.5 because the system, they paroled out. You know, they made a first parole. One of my clients got pushed out. I got a phone call from him the other day. Hey man, I'm out. Like, what are you doing out? Did 8 months on a two year, which was fine. He didn't get treatment. He didn't get nothing. They just spun him around. He went to a holdover, a classification joint, and then he went to the release center.
And a lot of states look at that. They're not even looking at the participation in treatment. They're strictly looking at, were you in trouble or not? Or did you stay out of trouble?
I'm just saying this because Bruce and Susan get blamed for everything. Bruce and Susan thinks people, you know, people this and that. Now Bruce and Susan are going to get, you know, accused of saying that we should let everybody free. We're not saying that, right? But if certain people earn this stuff, that's nothing different that's happening. Actually, it's a better way, if you will, because there's some method to the mat than just these states just pushing people out perfunctorily at half their date.
Right.
So, folks getting out of prison early is no new thing. It's just how they go about that, how that happens. That's what we're looking at here. So anyway, I just wanted to throw that in there because I'm like, absolutely. Oh my gosh, man, these guys are coming out.
We'll get blamed for that too. You know,
yeah, I mean, but these are the facts. I mean, I don't make this stuff up. My phone rings. Who is it? I mean, you know what I mean? So why is that? Because now over here, it's just a burgeoning, a huge system that's just bust full of folks and they're just getting people out and making decisions. That's fine. And you know what? It's their right to do it. And we'll see how parole feels about that, right? But that's their deal. And so that's the other thing too. We have federal probation on our cases in the federal system, right? And so if there's this mass exodus, how are these guys, you know, now they're going to be doing their time with probation 2 to 5 years on paper, you know, but of course they have their capabilities over there in federal probation to cut somebody's probation if they want to do so, right? So they're not necessarily doing that. Anywho.
But, you know, we talked about that. Yeah. That was one of the things we talked about last week, is kind of the reorganizing, reimagining how earned time credit is applied and allowing individuals that accumulate credit that they haven't been able to apply to early release or early halfway house to being able to terminate their supervision early, you know, coming
that
out.
Was the fourth bucket. Was that the third or the fourth bucket? Remember?
I asked third about bucket. That. Yeah, there is no third
there's,
bucket.
There's
right
no bucket.
There right. is none. I found it a comical early on. We had a case out of, I don't even remember what circuit it was, but it was the Dyer case. And everybody was citing the Dyer case. And the judge made a decision to apply credit to supervised release. And I was like, how are they doing that? Like, he just invented that. Or she, I don't even know if it was a man or a woman as far as the judge goes, but there's nothing in the law. And I can't tell you how many times I've been presenting a class or a lecture talking about time credits. And I'd be like, there is no door number 3. You know, that's all there is. early release, early halfway house. And I think early termination, again, if someone has done well in custody and we're letting a probation, a bureau, as their case managers are letting, you know, the probation office know, hey, he's done all of these things and he's had a good record while he's been here.
So is it fair to say that First Step Act is a Department of Justice program and then to tell people in the judicial branch about their paper, like, don't tell me how to do my...
Well, and I think it needs, that's why it needs to be statutorily done.
Right.
And, you know, obviously it would be at the discretion of probation and the judge, because that would be terminating supervision early. But I think it's reasonable, you know. You had some people get kind of squirrely about, we had suggested the idea that rather than have all of these time credits get applied to pre-release placement and clogging up the system and creating the current situation that we have, we had suggested that using that time credit be applied either as a function of the sentence or the function of time served, say up to 15%. And that was just kind of a number that we threw out as an example. And some folks kind of got kind of bent out of shape about that. And why would we suggest that? Well, part of the reason we said that, and of course, back to, I feel like Rush Limbaugh with my pieces of paper in front of me. In the Bureau of Prisons, now let me back up and say this. I'm going to throw out some math here because I actually did some math getting ready for today, right? If individuals were able to apply earned credit up to 15% of their sentence, that would mean anyone serving 6 years and 8 months or 80 months or more would receive more than a year off of their sentence. If it was 15% of time served, it would be 7 years and 10 months or 96 months or more, they would receive more than a year off their sentence. Now, some folks might be sitting there going, well, gosh, 6 or 7 years, or in this case, almost 7 or almost 8 years, that's a lot of time. Except if you look at the Bureau's population. So I pulled this today, and this is as of April 19th. So pretty recent data. More than 50% of the Bureau's population, 52.1%, is serving 10 years or more. The next category is 5 to 10. So, you know, you sort of can't parse that out with the available public data. But about 25% of the population is serving between 5 and 10 years. So somewhere, you know, whatever that number is, some portion of that group would also receive more than a year off their sentence. When it comes down to it, only 20% of the population is serving less than 5 years. And actually, only 11% are serving less than 3 years. So by focusing and kind of redistributing that credit, even someone with a shorter sentence still can earn time off their sentence, albeit less, but the rest of that time goes toward home confinement. And that's something else that you and I have talked about, that short of someone not having a verified release plan, FSA time should be home confinement. Individuals should not be going and taking halfway house space.
Right.
If they're on home, if they're on FSA time.
We talked about a 5-factor review and having the RRC make another review, like, this person has a home, they have a job, they have all these other, they have the ability to have the hardware, they have access to their own, you know, care and stuff like that. Wow, man. I mean, that just seems like it's a good situation. And I know, oh no, they haven't hit their 10% day, they haven't hit their home.
It would be irrelevant at that point, because the FSA, if they restructured,
right.
And so someone with a 20-month sentence, a 24-month sentence, they would have more credit than 15%. The 15% that earned credit could go toward that early release, and the rest of it go toward that guaranteed home confinement. And that the only people who go to halfway house with FSA time are those that actually need residential support. And then we eliminate the problem that we're currently in, where
We're not creating rumors here. This is right. This is a theoretical thing.
We're not creating rumors.
Go out there on the compound. Oh, Bruce and Susan said this today. Yada. Yeah. No, hold on a minute.
This is something Bruce and Susan think should happen.
So,
and if somebody were to say, ask us, we would say, hey, we think this should happen.
But I think they're asking these questions. I think the new director, and I think there are people asking these questions. You and I were approached by a bipartisan, but yet one partisan, you know, Senate folks about this. And I'm hoping we get to continue in those discussions with that very important committee that shapes a lot of things. And they'll listen to us as kind of nonpartisan content area experts. This is just the right thing to do. You have a law. This is the spirit of the law, and the Justice Department, it theoretically enforces the law. You know what I mean? And so, you know, that's really what we're getting to. And then look at best practices and look at things that are based on the risk responsivity needs responsivity models and those things that we're already doing with pattern and other stuff. We're looking at static and dynamic risk factors. We've been doing that for years, and doing that again, right, with some of these, doing a form of that risk assessment again, or refining that, I guess, Susan.
Yeah. I don't even know that it was necessarily refining. It was kind of formalizing it, you know. I forgot to show. You did not present a coffee cup. I have a coffee cup. I found my FPC Seymour Johnson coffee cup, practically an antique at this point in time, from 1991. But as a case manager, back when dinosaurs still roamed the perimeter, that's what we did. We were assessing education. We were assessing substance abuse. We were assessing parenting needs, treatment needs. You know, we would look at a PSR and it was, well, hey, you haven't completed your high school diploma. I want you to go over to education. You need to get enrolled in GED. You don't have a work history? Okay, after you get your GED, I want you to be talking to some of the different departments. We've got 6 DOJ apprenticeship programs. DOL, Department of Labor apprenticeship programs at this institution. Plus, we've got stuff going down in education. I want you to make some decisions. I want you to think about it. And we're going to talk about it as your next team. But right now, you need to get your high school diploma. You got a substance abuse history. Okay. We're going to send you over to drug education first. And after that, you're going to non-res. You know, we've done that for years. The only thing this did was kind of create a framework. There were some new assessments added, but the heart of it has been done for years. I mean, the Bureau has been doing trauma assessments since the mid-90s, we were at Carswell when they started doing the trauma assessments, right? I feel like it was like 94, 95, 96, somewhere in that time frame. So the whole notion of assessing trauma and trauma-informed care is not new. And it's not new to the Bureau. And, you know, and I think there were a lot of people out there who, when the First Step Act passed and said, oh, Bureau, you're going to do risk in the assessments, thought the Bureau wasn't doing that.
Right.
And they had been. The medical assessments, the care level system for medical was in place since 2001. And the mental health care level assessments came in just a few years after that. You know, they deployed medical first and it was working. And working as intended. And so they started doing the same thing with the mental health. And I want to say that was maybe 2005, 2004. I don't know. I've slept since then. So these aren't new things. you know, like I said, there were a couple of individual little assessments that were added, but the bulk of them were being done already. So, like, this is what the Bureau does. FSA right. didn't.
But all this stuff is now mainstream. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like you said, if you're working in a penitentiary and, you know, your caseload isn't coming out for 100 years, you're not worried about some of this stuff. Go to code, maybe go to challenge, whatever, get a residential program there, get, you know, stay out of trouble, this and that and the other. You're not thinking in those terms, right?
Right.
So, man, dude, even in a medium, right? You got plenty of lifers in mediums now, you know, or long, you know, guys with long bids.
But, you know, that's where I think we, not so much correctional professionals, the correctional professionals understand this, but the politicians, society, the other folks, whoops, don't hit the mic, the other folks. These are the folks, these guys in these penitentiaries and the medium security facilities, and they've got long criminal histories, and maybe they have violent offenses. These are the people that need to be targeted. These are the ones that we really need to be incentivizing
yes.
to participate in programming. Going back to that DOJ report, and I know this is going to be just an absolute shocker. In terms of security levels, minimums, lows, mediums, and highs, and what percent recidivates, 44.8% of folks in penitentiaries recidivate. Mm-hmm. Not really a surprise. Compared to minimum security, 2.8%. Talk about the pattern was a new tool. The pattern similar, there's a lot of overlap between the custody classification and pattern, but they are different. Pattern, of course, as a reminder, was created externally to the Bureau. It is validated annually externally to the Bureau. And if changes occur, the recommendations are made, Maine Justice approves them, and then the Bureau implements. The Bureau has zero impact there, right? They are just right.
So can you tell our viewers and listeners what you're reading off of? What's the title of that?
I'm sorry. I am reading off of the First Step Act annual report that was published in June of 2024. Report has to be, it's part of the statute that says they need to report, that right. they need to produce right. an annual report. Just like the law requires the pattern risk assessment to be validated annually and reviewed for changes, as well as the needs assessments are validated annually. And if you go to the report, it's available on the BOP website. If you go to the FSA resources and DOJ right. reports, it's the most current one. And it includes not only some statistical information, but some other benchmarks, some other things the Bureau is doing, the findings of the studies, recommendations of those studies, et cetera. So it's
right. And maybe we'll find a link to it and put it on the Facebook group,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, we can do that.
That way you can look at this. Everybody can look at this stuff. We're not reading double
not
secret,
secret stuff.
Stuff or just stuff that we pulled out of our nostrils. I mean, you know, this is all published stuff and has inter-rater reliability, has content validity, all this type of stuff that's kind of held up to a lot of pretty solid academic scrutiny.
Yes, absolutely.
So criminal justice professors and others, even others in the mental health field who were involved in this as well. So we got less than 6 minutes, just giving you the warning.
Okay. So just one last thing on the risk level is, again, looking at who is recidivating when it comes to pattern. Again, not surprising, less than 3% of minimum risk level individuals recidivate, which is what we would expect if you're minimum recidivism level. Compare that to high recidivism risk folks, 38.2%. Those are the folks that we need to be targeting for this incentives to do something to change, to start that path to choose something different. Now, will they? It's their choice. But right now, when most of these guys aren't part of the incentive. You know, they aren't included. And when it comes to criminogenic thinking errors, you know, you have folks who might be still in the what's in it for me right. kind of mindset because they haven't done anything. They haven't started talking about.
We'll run out of time before they hit the low pattern, low, you know what I mean?
Right, or right. But again, if they're incentivized to get involved early, to make some good decisions, that's awesome. That's awesome. And by linking all of this to maintaining refraining, because sometimes little stuff happens, but refraining from that serious and violent misconduct for the rest of their incarceration, that's where they're actually putting those classes and those programs and those treatment stuff, those treatment modalities to work and are actually making better decisions. And that will also mean safer prisons for the others in the incarcerated population and the staff, less lockdowns, more opportunities for program. I mean, it's just, it's a positive cycle that starts with that one individual changing their behavior. And then it's two and three.
Yeah, boy, if you could just stop some of the lockdowns. You know, some of these places get repetitively locked down and some of the usual suspects get locked down. But, man, that's just a painful process for everybody when you have an institution locked down and to be able to have maybe a population that was a little bit more incentivized and felt like they could see that light at the end of the, albeit a long tunnel, that would change some of the dynamic inside the institution.
And lockdowns mean overhaps having to pay staff overtime. That means people aren't doing their work because they're getting right. pulled onto to search crews and escort teams yeah. and everything else. Having spent 11 years in a penitentiary, lockdowns are very burdensome and they cost money. And they prevent programming and they prevent people, case managers from preparing halfway house paperwork and teachers from teaching classes.
The augmented staffing patterns and those things, man.
Yep.
Anyway, we won't go there because we have less than 3 minutes left.
Yes.
See how fast the time goes, folks. We're talking about changes. We're talking about the way these things could be more better applied, you know, and we're going to continue the discussion. And we want you to continue the discussion with us. Send us feedback on either the YouTube channel. Send us feedback or questions on our Facebook page, Early Release, you know, First Step Act, Early Release from Federal Prison. Ask us questions, you know, and we'll definitely respond, you know. I mean, you know, there's some opinionated stuff out there. We get it. Just don't shoot the messengers here, man. We're trying to get this ball rolling and kind of get some things going. And we have, we had a banner week. We'll talk about that next week. We might want to go over some cases. We had a banner week. Some folks got out of prison into halfway house earlier than they would normally would have if they hadn't have had some level of advocacy that was very specific and targeted and correct. But we'll save that for another day.
It's time to write books.
So here we go. The book. I have to get up every time too.
Same.
I don't have to travel far. Whoo, get my steps in, folks. Just kidding. All right, here's the green book. Here's a green book. What's this for? Classification. If you're new or going to be new to the Federal Bureau of Prisons, or you're just in that process of figuring out your legal defense and what that is going to look like in terms of your pre-sentence report and how you're going to be classified in prison, please get the green book and have your attorney get the green book too, if you know what I mean.
100%.
For sure, have the attorney get the book. All right. Now, First Step Act, right? This explains everything about the First Step Act, how it works, how you accrue it, how it gets applied. Those are available on Amazon, and you can have those shipped into the institution as well.
Yes.
So, and what else? We're on Apple Podcasts now. Amazon Audible in Canada picked us up now. Do you remember the other aggregators I sent you? No,
I let you handle that stuff.
Yeah, I do handle that stuff. I'm your guy for that. So we're getting out there. So you can come by, listen to, and view the show on YouTube, on LA Talk Radio. You can download the shows. You can view the shows. We're on YouTube. There's a Federal Prison Authority has its own. Actually, this podcast has its own Facebook now, Federal Prison Authority Around the Block. So I upload these episodes on there as well. So, all right. Well, don't be a stranger. Thank you for listening. Keep an open mind, folks, and let's just keep our heads up and our ears forward as we move forward into this next era of federal prison issues. So with that, we'll bid everybody a good week, and we'll see you here next week on Around the Block, presented by Federal Prison Authority. Y'all take care. Have a blessed week.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.